Good afternoon, you are tuned to Juno Afternoon here for Tuesday, the 24th of May, the year 2016. Jeff Brown with you, filling in for Lori Scanlon, who is stuck in traffic. Can you believe that here in Juno? Today on the show, Amy Skilbert from the Juno Community Foundation and Wayne Stevens from the United Way will be here to highlight the elementary school breakfast program with Adrian Schwartz. We'll learn about a unique teen kayak trip. We'll spotlight the Juno Reentry Coalition, and high school principals will be here to talk about graduation. That Writer's Almanac, we're on Music and More today on Juno Afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with scattered showers, low temperatures around 44 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, mostly cloudy skies with scattered showers, high temperatures around 55 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. According to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Issues, about 80% of complaints from Indigenous people around the world are over land and resources. Tristan Autone was at the recent UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and has this report.
Indigenous people are inordinately the victims of land and resource theft and exploitation. Victoria Tally Corpus, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Issues, said conflicts will continue globally if states pursue indigenous territories and act with impunity. In Honduras, for instance, Tally Corpus says the Garifuna along the coast are losing land to the government so they can be converted to charter cities.
Basically, these are like export processing zones along the coast. The ones like these are the Garifuna along the coast, whose lands are being taken away because the state is offering it to investors who can set up these like maquiladoras. Another is, of course, the infrastructure development like hydroelectric dams.
In places like Guatemala, Tally Corpus says extrajudicial killings and disappearances of indigenous leaders happens on a regular basis.
There's a lot of discrimination against indigenous peoples. They are considered uncivilized, backward, etc. And yet, if you look at these so-called uncivilized peoples, they are the ones who still live in a much better situation if there are no other interests coming into their communities to rob them, to take away their lands, or to pollute their lands.
The next step, Tally Corpus says, is finding more ways to secure basic rights for indigenous peoples and hold states accountable for their actions. I'm Tristan Autone.
Tribal and business leaders in Montana are exploring ways to grow Native American-owned businesses on reservations across the state. Reporter Katie Reardon has more.
Policymakers in Montana say that tribal economies in the state need to grow their private sectors to keep more money locally. In Montana, the Department of Commerce estimates that the private sector makes up about 80% of the state's economy, and the public just 20%. But on the state's seven Indian reservations, it's almost the complete opposite, says Heather Sober-Pena-George, an economic development specialist for the Commerce Department.
Indian country, by and large, is 20% private sector, if you're lucky, and then 80% public sector. That just creates a frailty in the economies that we have to change.
Sober-Pena-George spoke at a conference held recently in Montana. Tribal leaders, entrepreneurs, and government officials from four states joined her to talk about how they can create more opportunities for Native American-owned businesses. Sober-Pena-George said there's growing momentum to spur the private sector on reservations, but that progress can seem very slow.
Yes, we are moving the needle, but it's in one or two businesses at a time that employ one person, maybe full-time, maybe part-time, but the ancillary effects of that are that, you know, there's more money for that business owner to support their family, to purchase goods and services from other local businesses.
Tribal leaders say that some of the fastest-growing industries on reservations in Montana are tourism and construction. I'm Katie Reardon.
Tribal leaders, federal officials, and a U.S. congressman are holding an emergency meeting in Washington, D.C. today to discuss human remains and sacred objects up for auction in Paris. Representatives from Acoma Pueblo in New Mexico and the Hoopa Valley Tribe in California will discuss the issue with New Mexico Congressman Steve Pierce and officials with the State Department, Interior Department, and National Native Organizations. The emergency meeting is being held on the eve of an auction in Paris. Acoma Pueblo has been among tribes in the Southwest working to stop Native American items from being sold at French auctions. Tribes have fought in court and have gained support from U.S. lawmakers and groups such as the Holocaust Art Restitution Project. Tribal leaders say many of the items which go up for auction in Paris are sacred and need to be brought home. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Scoop Dash. Support by Ramona Farms. Happy to share our traditional heirloom food products. Wonderful additions to your family meals. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, spinola, traditional wheat flours, cornmeals, polentas, and much more delivered to your door from RamonaFarms.com. July 4th delivery available on orders placed at store.RamonaFarms.com by June 24th. Tom Yeh.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 24th of May, 2016. It's Bob Dylan's 75th birthday today, born Duluth, 1941. Grew up in Hibbing, just off Highway 61. Joined his first rock and roll band in high school. Headed for New York to meet Woody Guthrie, his hero. Started performing in clubs in Greenwich Village. Released his first album in 1962, called simply Bob Dylan. By 1964, he was playing 200 concerts a year, and by the mid-60s, he'd gone electric. Now has more than 600 songs in his catalog. It was on this day in 1883 the Brooklyn Bridge opened to traffic, which had taken 14 years to build. 27 workers died during the construction. It's the birthday of the poet Joseph Brodsky, St. Petersburg, Russia, 1940, a poet whose readings drew big crowds in the Soviet Union, and he was arrested on the charge of social parasitism. His trial in secret, but the transcript was smuggled out. His defense of the right to be a poet made him a hero, especially in this country and Europe. He was sentenced to 5 years in a labor camp in Siberia, but there was so much protest that his sentence was commuted after a year and a half, and he was expelled in 1972. Went to Austria, where the poet W. H. Auden took him under his wing, got him a job at the University of Michigan, and from there he went on to teach at Queens College, Mount Holyoke. In 1987, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. He died in 1996 at age 55. Joseph Brodsky, who said, "After all, it is hard to master both life and work equally well, so if you are bound to fake one of them, it had better be life." Brodsky also said, "There are worse crimes than burning books. One of them is not reading them." It's the birthday of the novelist Michael Chabon, born in Washington, D.C., raised in Pittsburgh. First novel, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, came out when he was just 25, a surprise bestseller. As a young writer, he read a lot of John Updike, Philip Roth, and Jorge Luis Borges. He said, "I just copied the writers whose voices I was responding to, and I think that's probably the best way to learn." Author of Wonder Boys, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier, and Clay. His newest book, Moonglow, comes out in the fall. Michael Chabon, who writes from 10 in the evening to 3 in the morning every day, Sunday through Thursday, at least 1,000 words a day. He says, "There have been plenty of self-destructive rebel angel novelists over the years, but writing is about getting your work done every day. If you want to write novels, they take a long time. The best environment, at least for me, is a very stable, structured kind of life." Here's a poem for today by Billy Collins entitled Despair. So much gloom and doubt in our poetry, flowers wilting on the table, the self regarding itself in a watery mirror, dead leaves cover the ground, the wind moans in the chimney, and the tendrils of the yew tree inch toward the coffin. I wonder what the ancient Chinese poets would make of all this, these shadows and empty cupboards. Today, with the sun blazing in the trees, my thoughts turn to the great 10th century celebrator of experience, Wahoo, whose delight in the smallest things could hardly be restrained, and to his joyous counterpart in the western provinces, Yee-Haw. Despair, a poem by Billy Collins from Ballistics, published by Random House and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Welcome to a Juno afternoon, and thanks for joining us. Taking a quick look at weather, I see the word cloudy repeated for most of the rest of the week, interspersed with isolated showers or chance of rain. I do not see the word sun anywhere between now and Sunday. But of course, we will keep you on top of that. By the way, if you're out on the roads, as I just discovered, inbound on Eagan is traveling at about 10 miles an hour, and the line forms at about Vanderbilt Hills. So plan some extra time if you are coming into town from out of town. I'm so happy to have with us as our first guest today, Amy Skilbred from the Juno Community Foundation, Wayne Stevens from United Way, and Adrian Schwartz with the Juno School District. And we're here to talk about something that is really fundamental, and that is breakfast for all kids in the Juno School District. Welcome. And Adrian, you've been with the district a long time managing the food service program. Were children not getting breakfast in the Juno School District?
There were breakfast programs established at the majority of our schools, but some of them were operating under the National School Breakfast Program, while others were volunteer donation-based programs.
So what did that mean for the district in terms of the ability to offer universal breakfast? Was it did it deprive us of having an opportunity to do something that was more consistent?
A little bit. What was happening in the past is we did have schools that were operating under the federal reimbursement program, the National School Breakfast Program. We had others who had the volunteer donation-based program. We did not realize that it was an option to operate what's called a universal breakfast program under the National School Breakfast program through the USDA federal reimbursement. We found that out 2 years ago when we started contracting with Chartwell's School Dining Services. They introduced us to that idea.
So what is changing, Amy? Talk about how the Community Foundation is involved in helping to provide a more consistent offering to kids in the morning.
Sure. The Juno Community Foundation and the United Way got together with several of the volunteers in the churches, the faith-based organizations, and people who were helping to provide not only breakfast but do the backpack program, looking at summer programs for food. And one of the things we talked about was, is there a way to fund breakfast, which, as you know, because the times changed for the schools, elementary school actually begins pretty early in the morning, which means getting volunteers there. I don't know, people were saying 6:30, 7 o'clock to help with breakfast programs. Also recognizing that federal funds were being left on the table, and not only here in Juno, but all over the state and then across the country in the millions and millions of dollars across the country. And so how could we utilize funds that were available from outside? What would it take in addition from our community to ensure that breakfast could be provided in some form at all the elementary schools? And so we're having hot and cold breakfast this coming year, choice at all of the elementary schools, and Auk Bay, because of their bus schedule, will have grab-and-go meals. They just get there a little bit too late to have that sort of breakfast option in the morning before classes start.
Wayne, what is the United Way role?
United Way has been working almost 5 years with the food bank, the food pantry, the faith-based community, trying to bring cohesion to the issue of dealing with food insecurity in the community. And so there have been lots of organizations sort of identifying what slice of the food insecurity challenge are they going to work on. And folks have been working on the volunteers in the breakfast program in the schools. There have been volunteers working with providing backpacks for kids on weekends, working with summer programs to provide services. And in conversations, it became apparent that there was a lot of overlap. And so what we've been trying to do is bring some semblance of organization so that we're not leaving resources unused, a la the USDA food program, working with state health and social service folks in the food services, SNAP, and other programs to make sure that we get the maximum benefit to our community to provide for those who are experiencing food insecurity. And I guess the school portion of it, I guess I was quite taken aback by the realization that kids ended up at school without breakfast, that maybe didn't have money for lunch programs, that left school on Friday afternoon in an elevated state of anxiety, not knowing that there would be no food available to them until they got back to school on Monday. So this is an opportunity for two great organizations, the Community Foundation and United Way, working in concert with the school district to really start to address some of those issues. And United Way has been big on reading and early literacy, and if you don't have food in your tank, you're not inclined to perhaps pay as much attention to the reading, writing, and arithmetic when you're listening to your stomach growl. So it's just a great opportunity to do what we think works best is everybody identify what needs to get done and then figure out who's going to be best positioned to get maximum benefit of the effort that is needed to accomplish programs.
So a coordination of resources.
Correct.
Has been your key role. Amy, how much did the Community Foundation put in to supplement or to bring this program whole?
Yeah, we put in a little over $13,000, and then with $5,000 from United Way, so the gap for the elementary schools between what the school district was able to do and what we could support, and the federal funds coming in was $18,000, a little over $18,000. And Adrian and the school district are going to be looking at the results and do we get a lot more kids eating breakfast? Does it, you know, help with certain schools? It's a lot more fun to eat breakfast with your friends. And so making sure that everybody can take part in it was one of the things that became clear to me when Wayne and I were meeting with several of the donors and the volunteers who are doing work at the breakfast program or the backpack program or other ones. So,
Adrian, let's give a shout out to some of the donors and volunteers who have provided breakfast for many years at some of the elementary schools. Can we credit some folks publicly and thank them, those who have stepped up and tried to help without maybe, you know, resources coming in?
Sure. Cindy Gagin, they've been helping with DZ and providing funds to assist with the DZ program.
Sharon Lowe has been coordinating a number of programs at Cedar Park for the school, Gastineau on Douglas. I'm trying to think of all the different, there's so many of them that's been part of the challenge. Pastor Terry with Shepherd of the Valley has been coordinating some of the summer youth programs. They've got a great program that starts here in June and runs into August where they provide a summer lunch program. Greening Park is
Northern
working.
Lights Church has
Northern
been
Lights
doing
Church.
It. I think Aldergate also.
We want to thank those community organizations for knowing that there's a need and for helping. Adrian, will this cost the school district any more, or will they save some funds now that they're able to access the federal reimbursement dollars?
That's a really good question. What we anticipate will happen is we'll have a huge increase in participation. We piloted this universal breakfast program at Glacier Valley starting fall of 2014, and then we expanded to Riverbend Elementary School this last school year, and what we saw was twice as many students participating in the program. That does increase our cost because the school district pays a per meal cost to a contractor, but it also increases our federal reimbursement. And so we took a close look at all of those financials when we formed this partnership, and that's where we came up with the $18,000 that we thought would be the supplemental finances needed to help the school district provide free breakfast for any elementary student who wants to have one.
So will this be sustainable after the first year? School districts across the state are facing shrinking revenues. Amy, will the foundation be looking at evidence? What's the chance that the gap can be filled in future years?
Well, sure. I think that Adrian is going to be following how many kids participate, how many free and reduced lunch kids, when they participate, it brings funds with them. So what's the gap? Is it this big? You know, we'll know after this year for elementary school what it looks like. It is always something that donations are needed, and you can give either to the Juno Community Foundation at junocf.org, or you can give to United Way at
UnitedWaySEAK.org.
You know, that brings up a good point, United Way campaign. Wayne, you and I, we've talked about this on this program before, and that is a relatively low percentage of folks at their workplace contributing to United Way. So if someone is listening, I encourage you to ask your employer about getting some information about how to donate to United Way vis-a-vis the workplace because of these kinds of programs. What will it take over the summer, Adrian, to be ready for feeding kids in the fall? Is that all left to the contractor?
It is definitely a partnership between the school district and our contractor, Chartwell's. We already have started those discussions. They are all set and ready. We have amended our contract. We worked with the Department of Education Child Nutrition Program to have these changes approved.
Well, thank you. And go ahead, Amy. I see you have a comment.
It's been really exciting to see the school district just react pretty nimbly to help to make this happen, and United Way and the Community Foundation, all of us coming together. I think our discussions on this were only months ago, and Adrian came up with the figures and working with the school district, and then we came up with funds. And so I think it's really exciting, and it'd be great to see kids turn out in the fall.
I think you will have hungry youngsters. That will be the least of the challenges. Thank you to Wayne Stevens of United Way, Amy Skilbred of the Juno Community Foundation, and Adrian Schwartz of the Juno School District's food program. Thank you for collaborating to bring universal free breakfast to elementary kids in the fall.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
Fun being here.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Lori Scandling with you, along with Jeff Brown, who is the producer of our program. In the studio is Sarah Ginter and Sean Isley, and we are going to talk about a kayak trip in July, but this one's specifically targeting teens. So, Sean, I know you're with Southeast Alaska Discovery, and Sarah, is that the organization you represent as well?
Nope, I'm from AWARE.
Okay, so it sounds like a team effort to sponsor this teen-centered kayak trip. So let's talk about it. It's set for July. What's the purpose? And Sean, you want to start? Is Southeast Discovery coordinating the trip?
Yeah, well, Discovery Southeast and AWARE are working together, and it's actually Discovery Southeast. We were started by Alaska Discovery 27 years ago with the idea that they saw a lot of people coming to Southeast and they wanted to get locals out. And so they started the Alaska Discovery Foundation. And then at some point down the road, that merged and became Discovery Southeast. So some people still know us as the Alaska Discovery Foundation.
I guess I'm dating myself by saying that, huh?
Discovery Southeast is the key word now. And yeah, this is a partnership between Discovery Southeast and AWARE. It's really great to work with AWARE. I think both these two organizations really care about getting kids outdoors who might not have the means, or actually just getting kids involved in the programs who might not have the means to do so. So it's great to be working with AWARE because both of our organizations have a big focus on scholarships and making sure these are accessible to kids that might not otherwise do this program. So it's a great partnership.
Sarah, how will the youth who participate in the kayak trip be chosen, or is it an application process? How will that happen?
Yeah, so we do have an application process that's open right now, and applications are due May 31st, so that's coming right up. And we have our applications available on the Discovery Southeast website, and they're all kind of being funneled that direction. So they can be sent to info@discoverysoutheast.org, and we'll just kind of sort through them and see and do any interviews that we need to do and just check and see who's great for the trip.
What is AWARE's role in co-hosting the trip?
So we're kind of bringing the violence prevention framework to this trip. Rebound has kind of started through AWARE and has been, I think this is maybe the sixth year or so. And so we are bringing, I'm actually going to be one of the adult facilitators, and so bringing this curriculum of violence prevention, helping youth to develop leadership skills, social justice, that whole aspect.
And is it for young men and young women, or are you targeting women?
It is for both, yeah, and we're undecided. Yeah, we're going to see how many applicants we get to see if we would have gender-specific trips, but most likely it would be mixed co-ed.
Sean, talk about the activities that will occur on the trip, and how long is it? I assume it's overnight, but how many days?
Yeah, it's overnight. It'll be for a week, July 7th to the 13th. And it's open to all high school age students. We should say there is actually a tuition of $500, and that's waived for any family that needs it, or it can be reduced for any family that needs it. So we're really serious about that. If this is something that you think would benefit a high schooler that you know, please send an email to info@discoverysoutheast. We can answer all your questions and send you an application. And on the trip, yeah, it'll be overnight for a week in northern Lynn Canal. We'll be kayaking and camping. And so, you know, there's a ton of just great experience and leadership that comes from being outdoors and feeling connected to the place and kind of moving away from, I mean, how many kids have been away from a computer screen for a week right now? That's kind of a cool thing to do. And then there's a great violence prevention component that AWARE is bringing that's a formalized curriculum. And I guess curriculum is a really boring word. Maybe I shouldn't have said that.
Although it's the right word. It's stuff you're going to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it should be a really fun trip. So that those two things balanced together, I think, will make it a great learning experience and just a really fun time.
Do you want youth who already have kayaking experience, or is that not a prerequisite?
That is okay, but not a prerequisite. Okay. Fine either way.
And how many adults per groups of youth will there be? In other words, what's the ratio of adult to youth supervision?
It's really high. I think we're going to have 9 or 10 kids on a trip and 3 adults.
So that'll be a good mix then. And you said high school, so I assume you mean going into high school. So you could have someone who's just finished 8th grade and ready to become a freshman?
You know, we've kept it a little bit ambiguous, and I want to see how the applications turn out. So if we see that we have a whole bunch of younger high school age participants, then I think that would be an option. On the other hand, if we have a whole bunch of kind of older age ones, then we'll choose that cohort, or we might select them by trip.
But you'll limit it to about 9 or 10 students then?
Yeah, and there are actually two sections going at once, so it's a total of 18 youth, and we're accepting applications from throughout Southeast. So I think we'll have a big a group from Juneau and probably a big group from Sitka and hopefully some kids from other communities too.
And will those two groups be traveling together generally the same route, or will these be two separate itineraries?
They'll stay separate. They'll stay as their own group just so they can develop those group dynamics and leadership skills and all that.
Will kids have to have camping gear that they already own, or will that be provided by Discovery Southeast?
We're working with Above and Beyond as an outfitter. They're a wonderful group to work with, and they will be able to provide anything that kids don't have.
Sarah, what is the heart of the curriculum on violence prevention? What is the takeaway or key message, and how is it conveyed? Is it through activities, through reading, through role play? Maybe you could summarize that.
Yeah, so I think we really emphasize the youth leadership part of this, and actually an important aspect to mention is that we'll have two teen facilitators for each program. So I'm going to be an adult facilitator, but I'm just basically going to be supporting the teen facilitators. And so it will be largely youth-led, which is very important to us. And so the teens that we choose for that role will really have a chance to step up and be leaders and kind of help support their peers in this curriculum. And so basically we have kind of focused on different aspects of, the Native, I forget what they're called, but the, yeah, I don't know, the Native values. And so you go mm-hmm. through that, kind of choose one per day. So like respect for elders, respect for self, respect for environment. And then also, just really having conversations every night about and having time for journaling and such about self-identity and how to stand up for yourself and for others and social justice and things like that.
So I'm guessing most teenagers are not listening to this program right now. We would expect they are in school, unless perhaps they're homeschooling. Mm-hmm. But if a caregiver, parent, friend is hearing this and they think, oh, I know someone who would be a terrific youth/teen facilitator, how might that person express their interest? Yes, there's an application process. As part of that application, is there a question that asks whether or not they are interested in a mentor/facilitator role? And do you provide training for that?
We do. We do have a full-day training for the teen facilitators, as well as the adult and all the staff that will be on the trip. And I believe as part of the application, they can indicate that they are interested in that position.
If someone had more questions about that role, Sarah, where would they give you a call?
At the where prevention, which I don't have the number with me, but you can call AWARE on the website. It's listed.
Oh, in the age of
AWARE.
Google, we forget phone numbers,
don't
we? And Sean, just to repeat, for those who want to find the application, can they just go to Discovery Southeast, and is Southeast spelled out, .org?
Yeah, it's all spelled out. And, you know, we just did a website upgrade, so I need to check. That was last night, so I need to check to make sure it's actually up. But if they have any questions, they can email info@discoverysoutheast.org. Like you said, Discovery Southeast is all spelled out. So info@discoverysoutheast.org. And I'll just make sure that's up on the website by this evening so people can go to Great. discoverysoutheast.org and get all the details.
Thank you. We've been talking with Sean Isley of Discovery Southeast and Sarah Ginter of AWARE about a kayak trip that will be occurring July 7th through the 13th. There will be two groups of teens, typically nine teens in each group. There is a tuition of $500, but scholarships and discounts are very much available, it sounds like, and there will be, as part of the trip, a curriculum about youth leadership and strength in youth behavior, it sounds like. For more information, you can look at the website, discoverysoutheast.org. It's for high school students. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Each year, by mid-May, a plaintive whistled song carries through the forests of eastern North America. It's the voice of the eastern wood peewee, returned to nest after a winter sojourn in South America. An eastern wood peewee perches inconspicuously in the shady interior of the forest. Inconspicuous, that is, until it sallies out to catch a flying insect. Or until it offers up that unmistakable song. But for the past 25 years, the number of eastern wood peewees has fallen across much of the bird's range. How is it that even a once common bird can decline so steadily? Fragmentation of forests into ever smaller tracts, as well as forest disturbance, such as heavy browsing by overabundant white-tailed deer, are part of the problem. So is the loss of forest in the bird's South American winter range. As a result, the eastern wood pewee is now a species of high conservation concern. What practices can help stem the decline of the eastern wood pewees and other forest birds? Well, providing economic incentives for private landowners who save forests is one. Enacting policies that promote smart growth and curb urban sprawl is another. To receive a weekly preview of the week ahead on BirdNote, and the most colorful email you'll receive all week, sign up at birdnote.org.
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center, now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Schedules are available online at juno.org/parkrec/Diamond Park. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
Thanks for staying aboard Juno Afternoon today. Lori Scandling with you. It's my pleasure to have with us today Don Habiger, who is the community coordinator of the Juno Reentry Coalition, Saul Neely, who is an associate professor of English at University of Alaska Southeast, and Chris Self from the Juneau Police Department. She is a liaison to the Reentry Coalition. Don, please define what the Reentry Coalition is.
Certainly. The coalition is a group of concerned citizens, and we're tackling kind of the high rate of recidivism. Those that are coming out of incarceration, at this point in time, 63% of those are going back into incarceration, and Juno wants to bring that number down by being, if you will, a warm handoff for those coming back into our community, so that they get connected to services immediately, and so that they can receive the help that they need, whether it's housing, physical health services, whatever they may be, so that they can be successful in coming back to our community.
I was surprised to hear on the radio, and I believe this was a national story, that part of the review now and changes being made in criminal justice actions, both on the national and the state level, are considering allowing those who are coming out of prison to receive food stamps. I had no idea that, I believe it's felons, could not receive food stamps, and it was a reminder of barriers that might be invisible, and I'm sure there are many. What would you say is the greatest barrier to reintegration for those leaving the prison system?
Do you mind if I pass that off?
You have two partners here, so you are welcome to pass the baton.
Not only is Chris part of our local coalition, but she's also part of the Justice Commission for the state of Alaska. So she has a dual role. She is heavily involved in this, and she has been looking at the research much longer than I have.
Great. Chris, why don't you tackle that one?
Sure. First, I'd like to say that the Juneau Police Department's interest in reentry is very selfish, because when people don't successfully reenter a community after being in jail, people like me or people dressed just like me end up having to chase them around and take them back into custody. And there's usually a new victim involved, someone who has lost property or been harmed by the person who was not successful in becoming part of our community again. So it's interesting that you brought up the food stamps. Despite being in law enforcement almost 19 years now, when I entered the Criminal Justice Commission as a governor's appointee, I also did not know felons couldn't get food stamps. In all of the many, many interviews I'd done with people who'd committed felonies, not one said, you know, I was really worried about that food stamp thing for when I get out. So I almost didn't do it, but then I went ahead and committed the crime. So I knew that most people were not doing any kind of cost-benefit analysis before committing a crime, because, as you know, most crimes are fueled by drugs, alcohol, and mental illness. That makes up the lion's share of the underlying causes. So food stamps was something that was used to basically threaten people into better behavior. Don't commit a felony because you won't get food stamps way down the road. Well, if you're talking about someone who's abused substances, they're thinking about the next few hours. They're not thinking about what's going to happen with the food stamps. So it wasn't really working as a deterrent. Now when somebody gets out of prison, there was concern, will these food stamps be diverted and traded for things like alcohol and drugs and sold and bartered and things that they were not intended to have happen? And yes, those things sometimes do happen. However, if someone is trying to go straight, if you're withholding food, that's way down on the hierarchy of needs. It's really, really difficult to accomplish much of anything else if you're lacking food. That's like lacking shelter. It's very, very basic. So hard to worry about becoming a better person or a better part, a better contributor to society if you don't have those basics covered. So yes, I can see the concern with diverted food stamps. I've seen drug texts that had to do with buying drugs after food stamps came in. However, drugs that get people off heroin are also sometimes diverted. I mean, there is the potential for abuse in almost every tool we have out there. So is it worth denying food to the people who are trying to support their kids and trying to do the right thing and trying to stay off alcohol and drugs? It seems like you're making, and what we have done, and we know this from the statistics, is we've made becoming a non-criminal the most difficult path. And being a criminal is now the path of least resistance once you come out of jail. And it's human nature, so that's why the majority of people coming out of jail continue to be criminals. And things like withholding food contribute to that.
Chris, we'll come back to some of those factors in a moment. I want to check in with Saul, Associate Professor of English at UAS. What is your role? What's your involvement?
Well, I started the Flying University, which is a prison education program at Lemon Creek Correctional Center, and I bring university students inside the prison for mutual and collaborative study. And what happened is we had some inside students who were very successful at that program inside the prison, and once they were released, they decided they wanted to come to UAS. And so that's what makes Flying University unique in the nation, is we're not just a prison education program, but we're also now a reentry effort. You can't do that in other locations. For instance, University of Oregon has a similar program, but once university students leave the prison, they're never allowed to talk to the inside students again. We can't do that in Juneau. It's just too small of a town. And so when the students began, formerly incarcerated students began coming to UAS, I became really invested in their success and thinking about all of the different aspects and barriers to successful reentry, constantly mentoring and negotiating the difficulties. And they're vast and they're myriad. And I think one of the biggest obstacles to successful reentry then is public indifference to the welfare of these people. It's about thinking community in new and rich and robust ways so that we understand that when people are incarcerated inside the prison in our community, they're not outside of our community. They're still part of our community. They're just incarcerated. And so I think my contribution here is not only in terms of education and trying to develop those opportunities, but also trying to get the community to rethink basic understanding of justice, responsibility, historical violence, and these kinds of things. And that's what tomorrow night's conversation is going to be about.
Tell us a little bit about where and when that will be, Saul.
Well, the Juneau Reentry Coalition, over the past several months, has reorganized itself according to the Alaska Prison Reentry Initiative, and we are having monthly community meetings. Tomorrow night's meeting is the first that will be based off of the ANDOR protocol. So what that means is ANDOR means Alaska Native Dialogue on Racial Equity. And it's a series of social technologies developed by the First Alaskans Institute to talk about racism and historical violence in Alaska. And about a year and a half ago, I was trained with those social technologies, and I've begun using them in my classroom and in a number of different public and community dialogues in Juneau. And so tomorrow night, the Reentry Coalition will adopt those social technologies to hold what will hopefully become a really rich and robust community conversation about reentry efforts. And the values that inform this discussion tomorrow night are such that we understand that people caught up in the system, their family, neighbors, victims, that this is a vast community resource that we have to tap into, and we have to listen to those who are caught up in the system. And so that's what tomorrow night's event is about. It's going to be two stages. We're going to do first stage is called a fishbowl, and we're going to have a small group of five people formerly incarcerated who will talk openly and candidly with one another about the barriers that they've experienced for successful reentry. And everybody else in the room will just listen to this candid conversation. And then the second part of the program will involve what we call the World Cafe, where we break into groups and we begin to reflect on what is it that we just heard and how can we harvest this wisdom and use it to help stage rich, robust, successful reentry efforts.
What time and where?
Northern Light Church, 6 o'clock to 7:30 p.m.
It's a lot of activity in 90 minutes. That
it
should
is.
Be
it's
a very interesting process.
Well-timed.
Don, what's your day job as coordinator of this coalition? What kinds of things do you do every day, and what experience did you bring to the Juno Reentry Coalition?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say you asked a question for Saul. What's his role? Chris has got the same role. They're part of my steering team. So they're my advisors. Right now, 10 folks have stepped up to be a part of that steering team. And my day job is really responding to them. But in that, the larger picture is a community plan, in fact, a comprehensive community plan, so that we have a methodical system to connect folks to services. Again, if you're going to achieve a recidivism goal, and the state really would like to take that 63% that I used earlier and reduce it by 20%, an aggressive goal, but we need that kind of a goal to plan for. And so that's our vision, that's our target, and finding that mechanism in a community using steering team, using the community voices, the dialogue that Saul is talking about, to come up with a plan so that we can, you know, connect folks. But more importantly, it is also looking at those assets, gaps and barriers. You mentioned food stamps. That is a barrier. How do we overcome that? Actually, I think that one may have just been overcome with the passage of legislation before they ended. But we have other things that I know we're a little bit tight on resources, mental health provision, for example. When I went around and talked to some of our stakeholders, those that provide services, they said they're at capacity, maybe near capacity. So if we find out later that we're having a hard time connecting somebody that needs mental health services, how do we expand that in our community? So that's part of the community dialogue. How do we get there? What are our gaps? How are we going to overcome these? How are we going to make a system that is seamless as possible to really achieve our goals?
Chris, as a member of the Alaska Justice Commission, and I hope that is the correct term, can you share what is perceived to be, based on evidence over time, perhaps the most successful strategy in deterring those who are transitioning out of incarceration from offending again?
Well, it's not really rocket science, because we know that substance abuse and mental health issues are what land most people in jail. And until you can manage those and provide the people that are struggling with those issues the tools to manage those, it just can't get any better. And unfortunately, those types of strategies are often seen as being nice to prisoners by offering them things like treatment and incentives to do well in treatment. So they go against what feels good to us oftentimes, which is a whole tough on crime concept that the meaner you are to people, the better they'll behave. Though anybody that's raised children knows that that's not true. And anyone that's worked with any other person knows that you can't get better behavior by treating people worse. And so we have this kind of internal battle that's going on, and it's resulted in, when I walk through the jails, I see hundreds of people napping and watching TV, people with really serious issues going on that are going to cause them problems once they're outside incarceration if they're not managed. And that's the substance abuse, the mental health issues. Sometimes it's literacy. Sometimes it's job skills. And we have all of this time with people incarcerated that people like Saul are starting to do a much better job of addressing what do you need to have a productive life once you're outside these walls. But it's a tiny slice that we're hitting now, a tiny, tiny slice. Mostly it's TV and naps is what's going on.
Thank you so much for bringing this deep and important topic to our studios. Today we're talking with Don Habiger, Saul Neely, and Chris Sell of the Juneau Reentry Commission about how those who are leaving prison can be, again, part of our community. As Saul said, they are part of our community right now. They just happen to be incarcerated. Tomorrow night from 6 to 7:30 at Northern Light Church downtown, there is the monthly community meeting sponsored by the Reentry Commission, and it will focus on a fishbowl and the opportunity to hear five individuals who are working on that transition. Again, thank you for your work.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
Every 2 minutes, another person is injured in a drunk driving crash.
Just a few sips impairs your judgment, concentration, and reaction time.
If you have been drinking, don't get behind the wheel.
Instead, designate a driver, call a trusted friend, or sleep somewhere else for the night. Because it's better to miss one night of sleep in your bed than to endanger yourself, a stranger, or a friend.
This message is brought to you by KXLL in support of the Taylor White Foundation.
Well, thanks to Jeff for choosing Schools Out for Summer. I thought it should be Pomp and Circumstance. Well, welcome to two of our three high school principals, Paula Dibdahl-Casperson from JDHS and Kristen Garreau from Yokuska-Dakahiti. And we'll also have information about the Thunder Mountain graduation as well. Paula, do you want to begin?
Sure. So we are celebrating our class of 2016 at our commencement ceremonies on Sunday, which is the 29th. JDHS has the 4 o'clock slot. It is a ticketed event at JDHS, but if people show up and don't have tickets, we're pretty confident we can get them in there to help celebrate the students and their accomplishments.
So Thunder Mountain then must be at 7 p.m. that
they
day.
They are. Thunder Mountain has the 7 p.m. Graduation, and they are out at Thunder Mountain High School.
And Yokuska-Dakahiti Centennial Hall, Kristen?
Centennial Hall at 1 o'clock. And it's a non-ticketed event, so it's open to anyone who'd like to come join us and celebrate. I think we have 36 or 37. You know, school's not out yet, so there are a few last-minute folks
couple might
scrambling.
Off, a couple might climb
exactly,
back on.
Exactly, exactly. But we'll have about 36, 37 kids graduating. It's great. Mm-hmm. It's really exciting.
It's kind of payoff day, isn't it, for guiding, helping, coaxing, coaching, hoping, nagging.
Mm-hmm. All of the above, definitely.
It's the time when people can pause and celebrate that that step in the education is now completed. It certainly doesn't mean it's done,
yeah.
But high school is for what it is through and on to the next step. Paula, anything special planned, meaning do you have the speakers chosen? Do you have a guest speaker or is it a nominated faculty person? Or
Actually, our commencement speaker is a faculty person who is graduating with the class of 2016 also. Our speaker is going to be Sarah Hannon, who's a longtime JDHS teacher, and she is retiring this year. And then we have a student speaker selected. Student's name is Grace Rodriguez.
Wonderful. And what about at Yakutsk? Often they have a special speaker as well.
We're going to be having some faculty speakers and some student speakers. So it's a little bit different of a ceremony. So we have, our advisors get to tell some personal stories about our kids and what they've accomplished in graduating. That for some people is kind of an easy feat, and for some people has had a lot of
been quite a journey.
So we spend a lot of time talking about our kids, and
it is a lovely experience to hear each student introduced as an individual by their advisor. Paula, how many grads at JD this year?
So we're anticipating 140. And I think that Thunder Mountain was anticipating 150 for their graduation.
Yeah,
a lot of graduates.
Pretty exciting.
Paula, any information you want to share on behalf of Thunder Mountain? And thank you for doing that. I know, as I shared with folks, the traffic in from the valley is at almost a standstill. So yep. I know Rhonda Hickok was going to join us today, and it's not possible.
I bet she's listening right now.
Hi, Rhonda.
So their community speaker is going to be Christy Erickson. And their valedictorian speaker is Max Suzuki.
That's exciting. Christy, of course, just received a Rasmussen Foundation grant. She is a spoken word poet and an organizer of many creative and artistic opportunities in our community. We're talking with our high school principals about the upcoming graduation. Paula, do you know how many graduations there have been at JDHS? I know Juneau High School was established around 1901. I'm just wondering if this is the 115th. It might be.
It certainly could be, to be honest. I had no idea. Do you want to just make that a thing? We could make that a thing right now.
I think we should just say that it's the 115th graduating class from Juneau High School.
And if someone knows differently, they should give us a call and let us know.
We know there are
historians
listening.
Someone might know. I know.
Yeah. And let's look ahead quickly to the fall. Anything that is special at your site or your school that will be new or different that folks should be aware of? We have about a minute.
I can't think of anything that is new necessarily. As soon as graduation happens, we look forward to welcoming our incoming ninth graders.
Do you have a freshman orientation day already set?
We do. We have in early August, right before school starts, the Friday before school starts, they'll do a freshman first day is what we call
Great.
It. Thunder Mountain will do one as well. And we're just looking forward to our new Crimson Bears joining in on some of the fun at JDHS.
All right.
Crimson. And we're signing up new students for Yakutsk. At Yakutsk Dakahiti, if you're interested in enrolling for next year, you can give us a call, 523-1802.
Or drop by
and just come visit and meet us.
Our district has wonderful high school choices. So just to repeat, the three graduations are set for this Sunday, May 29th, 1 in the afternoon at Centennial Hall is the Yakutsk Dakahiti graduation. It is a non-ticketed event at 4 p.m. at JDHS. Is that school's graduation. Tickets are required. That's just really to control the number of folks who come in. And at 7 o'clock will be the graduation at Thunder Mountain High School. Thanks for coming in today. It's a happy time of year.
Thank you.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau.